2026 is the year you launch your business. The year you transform into an entrepreneur, founder, a boss. You all just saw videos of Troy moving into his American Oddities Museum in a new spot in downtown Alton because we are always hustling to do better, and so can you. One powerful move puts your future firmly in your hands, starting a business with Shopify. Maybe you've got an idea you can't shake, a craft everyone tells you to sell, a store you've already designed in your head. With Shopify, 2026 is when you finally make it happen. Shopify gives you everything you need to sell online and in person. Millions of entrepreneurs have already made this leap, from household names to first-time business owners just getting started. Shopify gives you all the tools to easily build your dream store. Choose from hundreds of beautiful templates that you can customize to match your brand. Setup is fast with Shopify's built-in AI tools that write product descriptions and headlines and help you edit product photos. Marketing is built in too. Create email and social campaigns that reach customers wherever they scroll. As you grow, Shopify grows with you. Handle more orders, expand to new markets, and do it all from the same dashboard. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Shopify powers our American Honey's clothing store, as well as multiple other side projects that you all know me for. In 2026, stop waiting and start selling with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. That's shopify.com/hauntings. Hear your first this new year with Shopify by your side. Chronological age is your birthday. Biological age is how old your body really is. Biological age is the strongest predictor of disease risk and mortality. True Diagnostic gives you your biological age and health markers, plus a simple, personalized 90-day plan after analyzing over 1 million data points. I know a ton of our listeners feel like old souls, right? Well, it's important that we take steps to check in on our bodies right now. And that's where True Diagnostic comes in. Here's how it works. You order online and the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick, simple finger prick at home, then you drop it in the prepaid return package. You get digital results with an easy-to-follow 90-day plan in your inbox. Your only job? Follow the 3 recommendations for 90 days, then retest to see your progress. Let me break down some of the tests for you. True age. It measures biological age versus chronological age and your current pace of aging. It includes symphony age, which tracks the health of 11 organ systems: heart, brain, lungs, immune system, you get it. Gives your top 3 aging actions you can take to slow or reverse aging, and 86% of True Age users who follow the plan reduce their biological age. Then there's also True Health. It checks for over 105 vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and health markers, focuses on energy, metabolism, inflammation, and nutrient status today, and provides you your top 3 health actions for the next 90 days. Or you can do what we did and get the combo kit, which is True Age and True Health in one package. I've already set my test back and I'm super stoked to learn my results. So here's how it works. True Diagnostic uses advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million biomarkers. They identify the 3 most important actions you can take over 90 days to improve your health, and they are trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Personally, I'm starting to get old, and knowledge is power, and I have plans for the future, and I'm sure you do too. So right now, our listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code HAUNTINGS at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code HAUNTINGS for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
In the cold early morning hours of January 17th, 1909, a weary father named John McGowan was roused from his sleep by the sound of blood-curdling screams. But as bad as that sounds, they weren't the screams of someone in pain or danger. They were the screams of his infant daughter, wailing for all the reasons that babies do in the nighttime darkness. John glanced over at his exhausted wife and decided to let her sleep. He quickly got out of bed and hurried down a hallway to his daughter's room. "Shh," John tried to calm her, but the little girl wouldn't be soothed by his gentle sounds. He leaned into her crib and picked her up, holding her warm body next to his own. and almost immediately the crying stopped. And that was when John heard the sounds that had likely awakened her. They were coming from outside, next to the Delaware Division Canal, which ran directly behind the house. They were grunting, whistling, and scratching sounds, and unlike anything he'd ever heard in his life. John walked over to the window and pulled the curtain aside, peering out into the darkness. The only light was that of the moon overhead, but it turned out to be enough to give him the shock of his life. There on the edge of the canal was a large, dark-skinned figure with massive wings. It was tall, like a man, but had the body of an animal. It had short arms with what appeared to be claws on its hands, or paws, whatever they were. Its back legs, which the creature was standing on, were crooked like those of a horse. Whatever this thing was, it was hopping along the edge of the canal, scratching at the frozen ground and making barking, whistling sounds. John let out a frightened gasp that was so loud that his daughter began crying again. He dropped the curtain back into place and, with the little girl in his arms, hurried back to his own bedroom and climbed back into bed with his still sleeping wife. The baby soon dozed off, but John did not. He remained awake for the rest of the night, waiting and watching for the monster that he'd seen outside of his house. It was the devil, he knew. It had come back. He'd spent his entire life believing that it had been only a legend. But now that legend had come to life. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. As you're aware from previous episodes, we're beginning our journey back in time with the mysterious figure that served as the source of so much of America's fear. The devil himself. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And thank you for joining me for Episode 7, In the Pines. As was mentioned in an earlier episode, the Puritans and the early colonists found more monsters in America than just witches. The devil had birthed a variety of what were often called monstrous births, and they became signs and omens for the believers in an angry God. Spectral, shape-shifting dogs, along with demonic giant black bears, haunted the woods around the settlements. They were, as Cotton Mather claimed, surrounded by evil spirits in the sea, the rivers, lakes, forests, and swamps around them. But the Puritans were not the only ones finding monsters on the American frontier. Sea serpents swam in our waters, and strange beasts populated the wilderness that loomed over most new American settlements. But the response to the beasts the settlers met were not always the same, and didn't always share the Puritan desire to destroy all monsters or cleanse the American landscape, no matter how devilish the monsters might be. Instead, they turn them into legends. For example, tales of catfish that grow to monstrous size and show a kind of primal viciousness have had a long history in American lore. Stories of such fish in western rivers that were able to pull swimmers into the watery blackness, never to be seen again, circulated during the late colonial era. Perhaps the earliest stories of these river monsters came from French explorers Father Jacques Marquette and Louis Joliet, who in 1673 claimed that a giant creature slammed into their canoe on the Illinois River. The explorers later insisted the incident had occurred after local Native Americans warned them of a devil that lived beneath the waters and would, quote, drag them into the abyss. In 1780, a missionary who came to minister to several new settlements along the Ohio River reported that a giant catfish had dragged several fishermen to their deaths. The stories continue to exert a powerful hold on the imagination into the 20th century, as shown by a Kentucky tale of the remains of a human baby that was found in the gullet of one of the river monsters. Now here's an aside that's completely off script. When I was a kid growing up in Decatur, Illinois, there were stories that had circulated for years about giant catfish that lived below the edge of the dam that had made Lake Decatur. Stories had it that there had been divers who had gone down looking for, well, who knows, and came upon these giant catfish. And one of them, it was said, returned to the surface so frightened by the size of one of these catfish that he claimed it was the size of a small cow. Believe it or not. Anyway, belief in frontier monsters were spawned from the folklore of the old world and by the tendency of frontier communities to produce stories that scared the populace away from the shadowy forests and lakes that surrounded them. But in late colonial America, the question of monsters became a matter of national pride. A debate raged during the 18th century over a theory concocted by French scientists about American degeneracy. The theory claimed that the climate in America produced animals and human beings that were inferior to their European counterparts. While the theory didn't extend to the European settlers, although it came close, these scientists certainly believed the indigenous people to be of a lower race. Of course, the theory of degeneracy in America was nothing more than cultural propaganda pretending to be scientific theory. Colonial thinkers, including the likes of Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, responded with propaganda of their own, arguing, in fact, that the American continent had produced gigantic, powerful, and brutal creatures, unlike anything anyone had ever seen in Europe. The American wilderness, they stated, had produced monsters, and America's monsters were much bigger than those found anywhere else in the world. This discussion led to new debate over the discovery of, quote, giant's bones that had been found in New York. It also set off a wave of fossil collection that made the American mastodon the subject of public discussion and debate. Collecting fossils became a passion for amateur paleontologists, and during the American Revolution, the bones that were being found throughout the colonies became a symbol of national honor. Even George Washington, during one of the most difficult times for the Revolution, took time off to go fossil hunting. In 1780, Washington established the headquarters of the Continental Army near West Point, New York, as he contemplated an attack on the British stronghold of New York City. A snowfall in December gave him the opportunity to travel to a nearby farm where a giant tooth had been discovered. In 1781, Thomas Jefferson wrote a natural history of his home state of Virginia and discussed the fossils of the mastodon in detail. He believed the creature was not only the largest to ever shake the American continent with its massive stride, but insisted it was the largest creature that had ever inhabited the earth. Some American thinkers weren't convinced the bones belonged to an animal, though. They saw the fossils as proof of the biblical accounts of giants, rather than a symbol of national superiority. Ezra Stiles, who was president of Yale University from 1778 to 1795, at first refused to accept the idea that the gigantic teeth being unearthed in America belonged to a creature anything like a mastodon. Stiles instead embraced what he called the doctrine of monsters, which was the belief that anomalies like gigantic fossils proved that the wonders of the Bible existed on the American landscape. Stiles admitted that most natural scientists believed the bones belonged to four-legged animals, but he insisted they belonged to giant humans. His writings on the subject excited those who wanted to believe that biblical history had a place in the history of the new nation, especially since Stiles was considered a major intellectual celebrity in the early American public. But thankfully, Stiles eventually changed his mind. Thomas Jefferson, who was shocked by someone so prominent believing in something so stupid, began a correspondence with Stiles that eventually led to the university president's understanding of fossils, bones, and archaeology. But even so, his belief in monsters gained new life in a popular account from the Kentucky Territory that portrayed fossil finds at a place called Big Bone Lick as the uncovering of evidence of a true American horror. The book was written in 1793 by John Filson and was given the less than sensational title of The Discovery, Settlement, and Present State of Kentucky. It portrayed the mastodon as the, quote, tyrant of the forest and perhaps devourer of man. Filson's strange travel guide portrayed the frontier as a land of Native American graves, restless spirits, and, of course, the bones of monstrous creatures. He imagined the plant-eating mastodon as a raging carnivore and suggested that the Native inhabitants had once formed a confederation to destroy the monster because it would have otherwise brought about the extinction of all the other animals in the region. Filson had used the discovery of some mastodon bones to create a secret and terrifying history of America in which humans had been terrorized by creatures out of an H.P. Lovecraft story. But Filson didn't just talk about monsters. He also produced the first series of stories about Daniel Boone. Boone was an actual historical character, a Native American fighter and a land surveyor who made claim to vast tracts of land on the Kentucky frontier in the late 18th century. Filson, who had traveled with Boone on an expedition through the Cumberland Gap in search of settlement sites, transformed him into America's first frontier superhero. Filson's writings contained a brutal reality about early American history. Daniel Boone and men like him did travel west of the Appalachians during that period, killing and pushing out the Native people. In national mythology, Boone became a symbol of the American masters of the frontier, winning out over a brutal nature that had once been the home of Filson's, quote, tyrant of the forest. American settlers desperately wanted to be the monsters of the savage beasts of the wilderness region, but they'd eventually find out that some monsters refused to be tamed. During America's colonial period, the vast region west of the Appalachians was an untamed frontier and home to many stories of monsters and demons, but there were some wilderness areas that were much closer to home. The Pine Barrens of southeastern New Jersey was one of the most rugged places in the colonies, a region of vast forests, sandy soil, and patches of swamp. But even in the early days, population encroached on the Pine Barrens in the form of dozens of industrial towns and villages. Furnaces and forges throughout the area produced munitions for the American cause during the Revolution, during the conflicts with the Barbary Pirates, and the War of 1812. In the mid-19th century, though, a better grade of iron ore was found in the West, and production in the Pine Barrens went into a decline, and most of the population moved on. But that was in the future. When Americans first began trying to tame the Pine Barrens, stories began to filter out about a strange creature that lurked in the forests and swamps. Usually reported as a large leathery monster with wings, more than 2,000 sightings of the creature began in the early 1700s, and some say continue to this day. First given its name during a time when diabolical beliefs ran rampant in America, the beast quickly became known as the Jersey Devil. The origins of the Jersey Devil is shrouded in mystery as the very existence of the creature itself, but it shouldn't be surprising to hear that a marginalized woman and the devil himself are at the heart of the story. According to legend, a poor woman named Jane Leeds discovered that she was pregnant with her 13th child in 1735. Overwhelmed with trying to keep her large family fed and clothed, she told her friends and relatives that, quote, the devil can take the next one. And he did, or so the story went. When the baby was born, he was a monster. He immediately took on a grotesque appearance with a reptilian body, a horse's head, bat wings, and a long forked tail. There's no record of what Jane thought about this monstrous child, but, well, let's be honest, it couldn't have been good. The devil thrashed about the Leeds home for a bit and then vanished up the chimney to terrorize the surrounding region, proving that it's a good idea to be careful what you ask for, especially where the devil is concerned, which of course was the moral of the story. Even though the origin of the devil was likely pure invention, the monster itself seemed to be real. I mean, something was out there in the Pine Barrens, carrying off large dogs, geese, cats, small livestock, and even occasional children. The children were never seen again, but the animals' remains were often found. The devil was also said to dry up the milk of cows by breathing on them and to kill off the fish in the streams, threatening the livelihood of the entire region. In 1740, the frightened residents begged a local minister to exorcise the creature, and the story stated the exorcism would banish the monster for 100 years. However, the devil returned to the Pine Barrens on at least two occasions before that century was up. Legend has it that naval hero Commodore Stephen Decatur visited the Hanover Ironworks in the Pine Barrens in 1800 to test the foundry's cannonballs. While on the firing range, he allegedly saw a strange creature flying through the sky overhead. Ordering his men to take aim and fire on the creature, Decatur watched as the monster crossed the sky. His men would later swear that the beast was struck by Decatur's cannonball, but the devil just flew off. The second sighting took place a few years later. This time, the devil was seen by another respected witness, Joseph Bonaparte, the former king of Spain and the brother of Napoleon. He leased a country house near the Pine Barrens from 1816 to 1839. He reported seeing the Jersey Devil while hunting game one day. And then in 1840, as the minister warned, the devil returned and brought terror to the region once again. It snatched sheep from their pens and preyed on children who lingered outside after sunset. Livestock vanished and were found slaughtered, and residents caught glimpses of a winged monster that were accompanied by chilling screams and inexplicable cloven hoof prints that were left behind. People across South New Jersey locked their doors and hung a lantern on the doorstep, hoping to keep the creature away. In 1859, the devil was seen in Haddonfield and then vanished until the winter of 1873, when it was spotted near Bridgeton. For the next two decades, the monster was spotted over and over again. Livestock vanished and residents reported screams in the night. Finally, though, by the turn of the new century, the stories faded away, and most people began to regard the Jersey Devil as nothing more than a local urban legend. Until 1909, when that legend returned to life. That year, the Jersey Devil returned, and literally hundreds of people reported seeing it or saw its footprints. The hysteria became so bad that schools closed across portions of the state, and people refused to go outside after dark, or often even in the daytime. People were terrified, and maybe for good reason. The first sighting occurred in the early morning hours of January 17th. A man named Thack Cousins of Woodbury was leaving a local hotel when he heard a strange hissing noise and saw a blur of something crossing the street. As the figure vanished into the darkness, he saw the movement of wings, and then the thing turned in his direction, and he saw two glowing white eyes. It was on that same morning that John McGowan was awakened by the sound of his baby daughter crying and saw the winged creature outside the nursery window. But John wasn't the only one to see the devil that morning. Nearby, a police officer named James Sackville also spotted the monster while walking his beat. He was passing a dark alley when the winged creature hopped into the street and let out a horrific scream. He ran toward the creature and it hopped backward in retreat. He then fired his revolver at the beast, but it spread its wings and flew off. Not long after the devil dodged the policeman's bullet, the creature was spotted by Postmaster E.W. Minster. He woke up around 2 a.m. and heard what he called, quote, eerie, almost supernatural sounds outside of his house. He looked out and saw a winged creature fly past his window. He said it had a long neck, long back legs, and shorter legs in front. The devil let out a cry and a whistle as it disappeared into the darkness. The following morning, people all over the area woke up to find strange hoof prints in the snow. The tracks circled homes, went up to doors, and prowled around trash cans. They climbed trees, skipped from one rooftop to another, trampled across fields into the streets, over fences, and then vanished, as if whatever had made the tracks just flew away. General panic gripped the area. Doors and windows were bolted, and people refused to leave home, especially after dark. Those who ventured out went in search of the creature. Attempts were made to capture and kill it, but all were unsuccessful. More sightings and encounters occurred on January 19th. A man named Nelson Evans and his wife were awakened by strange noises outside and nervously peered out the window to see a large animal on the roof of their shed. They watched it stamp back and forth for nearly 10 minutes and described the devil in this way. Quote, "It was 3.5 feet high with a face like a collie and a head like a horse. It had a long neck, wings about 2 feet long, and its back legs were like a crane and had horse's hooves. It walked on its back legs and held up two short front legs with paws on them." Mrs. Nelson added that when the creature flapped its wings, it made a muffled sound, quote, "like when a wood saw makes when it strikes a rotten place." A drawing based on the Nelson's description appeared in the Philadelphia Evening Bulletin and became the most famous version of the creature. The sightings went on for weeks, and witnesses to the monster's antics numbered into the hundreds, including several firemen in West Collingswood who tried to knock it out of the sky with their fire hoses. Several monster hunts were organized, but never got close enough to the devil to shoot it. They found dozens of tracks in the woods and fields around many South Jersey towns, but all the trails ended suddenly when the creature apparently took flight. In South Camden, a woman named Mary Sorbinski raised an alarm after the devil attacked her dog. Several police officers rushed to the scene, and in front of a crowd of curious neighbors, they emptied their revolvers at the devil, but it escaped without a scratch. The daughter of William Pine from Camden was bringing her father his dinner pail when she stumbled across some strange tracks in the snow. She became so frightened that she fell into a dead faint. Her father and others examined the tracks and said they resembled a donkey with only two legs. Another witness was Reverend John Purcell, who said that he, quote, "had never seen anything like it before." The devil was seen late one night by a trolley car engineer named Edward Davis. He was shocked when he saw a strange figure leap across the tracks in front of his trolley and then disappear into the darkness. Davis said that the creature resembled, quote, "a winged kangaroo with a long neck." In the early morning hours of January 21st, the devil made a frightening appearance in Camden. Members of the Black Hawk Social Club were finishing a gathering around 1 a.m. when they heard an uncanny sound outside the back window. One of the men looked out to see a gruesome face looking in at him and let out a scream. The other club members fled in terror, but that man grabbed a club and waved it at the creature, which flew off, screaming out, quote, "blood-curdling sounds." Eyewitness accounts of the Jersey Devil filled the newspapers, along with photos and reports of cloven footprints that had been found in yards, woods, and parking lots. The Philadelphia Zoo offered a $10,000 reward for the beast's capture, but there were no takers. Schools closed due to a lack of students, theaters canceled performances, and mills and factories were shut down when workers refused to report for their shifts. Then, as suddenly as it had come, the devil vanished into the Pine Barrens again. The stunning events of 1909 had come to an end. Up until that time, it was always assumed the Jersey Devil was nothing more than an old wives' tale. But now, the entire region had been the scene of this mythical beast's rampage, leaving hundreds of eyewitnesses in its wake. That wouldn't be the last time the Jersey Devil was encountered. It was seen again in 1927 when a cab driver was changing a tire along a lonely road one night. He had just tightened the last lug nut when the cab began shaking violently. He looked up to see a huge winged creature crouching on the roof of the car. The driver, leaving his jack and flat tire behind, jumped into the cab and drove to the nearest police station, where he reported the encounter. In August 1930, farm workers reported seeing the devil crashing through the fields and devouring blueberries. It was reported again 2 weeks later, just north of Leeds Point, and then it disappeared again. In November 1951, a group of children were allegedly cornered by the devil at a park in Gibbstown, but it flew away without hurting anyone. Reports claimed it was spotted by dozens of witnesses over the next few days, and then it vanished again. Sightings continued here and there for years and then peaked once more in 1960 when blood-curdling cries terrorized a group of people near May's Landing. State officials tried to calm the nervous residents, but no explanation could be found for the weird sounds. Policemen nailed signs and posters everywhere, stating that the Jersey Devil was a hoax, but curiosity seekers flooded into the area anyway. Harry Hunt, who owned the Hunt Brothers Circus, offered $250,000 for the beast's capture, hoping to add it to his sideshow attractions. It was good press for the circus, which of course was all he wanted, but the monster was never caught. In 1993, a forest ranger named John Irwin was driving next to a river in South Jersey when he was startled by the devil appearing in the road ahead of him. He said that he and the creature stared at one another for several minutes before the devil turned and hopped away into the forest. So, as you can see, it turns out the Jersey Devil is not just a relic of America's past. Even today, isolated sightings of it still take place, but they are few and far between. It seems that since paved roads, electric lights, and modern conveniences have come to the rugged Pine Barrens, the monster has retreated further into the wild, refusing to leave its home. This lack of sightings has caused many to believe that the devil is simply an urban legend, a myth from early American folklore and a product of nothing but mass hysteria. But, you know, that's what everyone thought in 1909, too. And look how that turned out. It's possible, just possible, that the Jersey Devil is still out there, lurking in the wilderness, just waiting for the time when it returns to wreak havoc again. Thanks for listening to this latest episode, and I hope you'll stay with me for just a few more minutes to hear some of the latest news and announcements from American Nightmares. We have a hard deadline of January 5th coming up for one of the events at Dead of Winter. The free daytime food drive will be February 7th, and we'll be collecting canned goods, non-perishable items, and anything else that you think will help out folks in need as your admission to the event. This is our 27th annual Dead of Winter, and we'd love to make this our biggest year so far. We're partnering with Franklin Lodge in Alton, where the daytime events and ticketed after-hour events will be held. And speaking of those, they are filling up quickly. We have a Black Mirror workshop, a ghost hunt at the lodge with like two spots left, and a Devil Came to St. Louis dinner event with me. Those do require a reservation, and a portion of the proceeds from each of those also goes to help the hungry in the region. But here's where we have the deadline. We also have a special VIP event that's being held at the new American Oddities Museum on Friday night, February 6th. That's the night before Dead of Winter. And those guests will receive one of the limited edition shirts for this year. However, we do have a deadline to sign up for that because we have to order the shirts. So if you'd like to attend the VIP event, you have until January 5th, that's next Monday, to sign up for that. So don't miss it, and we'll hope to see you there. Now, just 1 week after that deadline, tickets go on sale for the 2026 Haunted America Conference. That's on January 12th when those tickets go on sale. The website is available now for the conference at ghostconference.net, and you can check it out to see this year's roster of speakers and presenters, after-hour events, tours, ghost hunts, workshops, everything else you need to know. Vendor spaces are already available for 2026, but probably not for much longer because they're really filling up fast. If you're hoping to have a vendor booth this year, you don't want to wait much longer to get that booked. And finally, mark your calendars for January 17th, when we'll be holding our grand reopening celebration at the new location of the American Oddities Museum in Alton. We'll now be at 301 Piazzal. Our first event will be held the following weekend in Alton Seance, followed by our first dinner, The Devil Came to St. Louis, on January 31st. But things are really coming together, and the new museum space is going to be even bigger and better than what we had before. So we hope to see you on January 17th to check it out. And with that, I'd like to wrap things up by saying thanks again for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows in the network and recommend all of them to friends, family, people you work with, anyone you think would love them too. If you do have thoughts or comments about American Nightmares, leave us a review or text your comments to the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. I have not been great about checking that lately because we've been buried working on the museum, but I swear to you, I will be checking it. Well, as a thank you, we've got a discount code. That's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. That website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really a small business that's grateful for all your support, because we couldn't and wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you, and good night, good luck, and I'll see you next time. As long as the devil doesn't get you or me first.